So today I am joined by a disgruntled ex-employee. He left under a cloud, but we settled it with a non-disclosure agreement. Welcome, Jay.
It's great to be back, Dean. Thanks for that one.
How do I introduce? So he didn't leave under a cloud. We haven't got a non-disclosure. And
if we did, we couldn't talk about it.
And hopefully you're not disgruntled, right?
No, I wasn't. I think that's cleared the air nicely, Dean.
No, Jay, you were with us during the pandemic.
I was, yeah.
You parked your business whilst you were, you know, everybody was locked away.
Yep.
Came, joined us for the team.
Yep.
Pandemic opened, launch off into the thing, the world, then leave the house.
Yeah. It was exciting, right? After all that time of the same four walls.
Yeah, it's almost like the pandemic never happened, except we've got more cases now than we've ever had.
Yeah. It's all over now, isn't it? Yeah. You know, we've got new things to worry about these days, haven't we?
So that we don't lead people with the wrong impression because of the way I opened the podcast, do you want to tell everybody a little bit about what you do and who you are?
Yeah, sure. So I am a disgruntled former employee of Dean's. No, I think it's pretty accurate. No, I've been working in the fitness industry for the past 10 years, and more recently my focus has been on working with organisations rather than individuals. So my focus is around helping organisations and their people change their habits, their routines, their lifestyle, so as to improve their mental and physical fitness and avoid things like burnout, avoid things like high levels of staff churn and absenteeism and stuff like that before it happens. Because a lot of organisations are quite heavily focused on remedial solutions, yeah, like employee action plans, assistance plans, mental health first aiders. They've all got a place and they're all really, really important. However, it's the first aid kit, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, triage.
Yeah, exactly. And you need those things in case accidents happen. You need a first aid kit. But it makes a lot of sense to improve the environment to avoid those accidents happening in the first place. So I come at it from a very preventative angle, and that's what I do. I go into organisations and I deliver workshops, trainings, and help them support their people better.
So thinking about the way the world is right now, there is more baseline anxiety in the world post-pandemic than there was before.
Yeah.
Because human beings aren't designed to live in a permanent sense of crisis.
No. It's supposed to be, you know, we deal well with acute stress as a rule. I mean, obviously there's exceptions to this rule all the time, but we've evolved to deal with short bursts of intense stress. And if you go back far enough, and that would be things like severe hunger for a short period of time, or a very high temperature, a very low temperature, infection, things like that we can deal with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, stuff like that, right? Short bursts.
Happens every day.
Exactly, you know, it's just part of life, right? Here in deepest, darkest Devon. So we deal well with those things, mm-hmm, usually. But what we don't deal that well with is chronic stress, where it's maybe at a lower level, but it's constant and there's no respite from it. And yet that is the kind of stress that we tend to deal with on a daily basis now, because our ancestors didn't have to deal with an overflowing email inbox, for example. Yeah. Whereas now that's something that's always on our mind. If we're running a business, then it could be where's the next sales coming from. If we're working within an organization, it could be deadlines that have been given to us by, mm-hmm, our superiors. But there's always something. Mm-hmm. And outside of work, it can be things like relationships, or it can be family stuff.
I think life is just really complicated.
It's a lot more complicated than it used to be, absolutely.
I mean, you know, if you think about, I can remember a good friend of mine, I've not seen him in years, but I see him on social media. I don't know if that's the same thing, but I've not seen him in years. He came out of school and had no idea how the world worked. And suddenly you realise, hang on a minute, my home life's complex because I've got all of these different bills to pay. I've got this stuff to do, clubs for the kids, all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I've got all of these variables in work. Oh, and by the way, we'll put this underlying anxiety of the economy in turmoil because of inflation now, but the pandemic and companies locking down and companies uncertain whether their business model still works. So you're going, there's this underlying, it's not just if I'm good at my job now, it's I might be good at my job, but my job might not exist. hopefully we're not sinking people lower and lower watches.
But we'll bring them back around, don't
worry. You've got all of this stuff going on, and it's like, I know from my point of view, I'm running a business, I've got my day job to do,
yep.
I've got to think about everybody else's, drive the business forward, and I've got a home life, and two kids, two grown-up stepkids, a wife, a dog, two cats. That's it, I think. So life is just generally complicated.
Yeah, it is. And I think that when you look throughout history, it has become, there are a lot more plates to spin now than there were before. And where our focus used to go, the only thing we really had to worry about for a long time as a species was survival. Mm-hmm. And now, for the most part, it's not quite about survival, especially in, you know, we're in the UK, we don't have to worry about necessarily where our next meal is going to come from. There are safety nets if that is a problem. They're not perfect safety nets, but they are there in a way that they weren't in the past. You know, in the past, if you didn't have food, you starved to death. Mm-hmm. And so that was your biggest stress. There's a book by an author called Mark Manson. I don't know whether you've probably come across him. His second book, Everything Is Effed.
I've read the first one.
The first one, yeah. So his follow-up to that, I don't know whether you've come across it, but the premise is that hope is a necessity for human psychological health. Mm. We need to feel hopeful. And in order for us to feel hopeful, we have to have problems, because hope is the feeling that things can get better. And if everything's already perfect, then we can't have hope. So there's this. His idea is that we no longer have to worry about survival and these real base needs as an organism. Mm-hmm. So what we do is unconsciously create problems that we can feel hopeful about, and the problems that we've created for ourselves, or that we view unconsciously as problems, have become a lot more long term. Mm-hmm. And they don't really have a solution. It's not as simple as find the meal, survive for another day. It's now, there's too many moving parts, and it's become quite overwhelming for, I think, for a lot of people.
So I got two pieces of advice too long ago, but they've always stuck with me. You know when somebody says something that's so obvious, but it just sticks with you?
Yeah.
It was two bits. One bit was, whenever a problem comes, there's the worst outcome and the best outcome, and the real outcome's probably somewhere in the middle.
Yep.
Because sometimes when you have a problem, fear and that anxiety goes totally out of control. And actually, when you go there and go, actually, this is not what's going to happen, it's actually going to be somewhere in the middle of the best and the worst outcome.
Yeah.
Now, some people listening to that might go, I'm not sure that's good news, but actually it is if you've got anxiety and you overthink. I'm a terrible overthinker. I process things and get tunnel vision about something. So it's a great strength, but when something's going wrong, it preoccupies me a lot. Can't do anything else until I've found an answer to it.
Catastrophizing, that's a word.
Yeah.
I think I've heard that word used. Doesn't mean it.
So that was the first piece of advice. It's always going to be somewhere in the middle of what you actually think could or couldn't happen. So that's the first piece. And then the other piece of advice was, the reality of modern life is all you do is trade up your problems.
Yeah.
So we look at, say, millionaires and billionaires, and we see them, you know, oh, they fly around the world and all this kind of stuff. And you look at that and go, they've got it so much easier. But actually what they have is, we might have, you know, this size problem, but they've got much bigger problems.
Yeah.
And the risk, I don't know whether you've seen the video with Elon Musk, where he's trying to launch SpaceX and Tesla, and they're both running out of money.
Yeah.
And he has 30 million left.
Yeah.
That's all he's got, 30 million. So we look at that and go, 30 million? But he said 30 million wasn't enough to solve his problems in Tesla and SpaceX. So he had the choice of, do I put the money into one and let one fail, or do I split the money and risk them both failing?
Yep.
And he's got however many hundreds of people, thousands of people at that point on it. And life is a journey of trading different problems.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that that can be quite, and although, you know, we said earlier on, it's like, hopefully we're not putting a downer on people here, because now we're talking about you're always going to have problems, and there is no point you can reach where you are problem-free. And I would argue that that's quite an empowering thought.
There's relief, because yeah, suddenly
the pressure's like, off to a
this
degree.
This is normal.
Yeah, it's not just me. It's not just me who's struggling, but everyone's got these challenges. And I would also argue that not only is, and if we talk about it in terms of stress, again, because I see problems and stress are kind of synonymous in a lot of ways, because I don't refer to the feeling of stress as stress, because I think it's too vague. I often talk about stress from a as the external thing. So if we looked at, you know, in physics, when stress was originally used up until the 1930s, it was the only context that the word stress was used in, and that was in a physical sense, which is the tension on a piece of material. So, you know, like a truck driving across a bridge, there's stress on the bridge. If you try and bend a piece of metal, there is stress on that material. And it was only then started being used in a biological sense, again, stress on an organism. And then it became the meaning that most people use colloquially, which is like the feeling of stress. I prefer words like overwhelm, frustration, stuff like that, because it is more descriptive and more specific. So problems external to us, those are the stresses on our life. And not only are they inevitable, but they're actually useful. They're necessary, because without them, we can't progress. So if you think about the context or the analogy that I use a lot of the time, having come through the fitness industry, is that when you go to the gym and you do a workout, if it's challenging, your body will then adapt to that. And when you get stronger or fitter is after you've done the workout, when you rest and recover. If you go in and you do a workout that doesn't challenge you, you don't get any fitter and stronger. And the same is true mentally, emotionally, and so on and so forth. If you don't have problems, you've got nothing to overcome and nothing to adapt to.
You're building your capability as a human.
Absolutely.
I think that's the danger. I mean, it's like everything in life, isn't it? If you have it in moderation, it can be helpful.
Yep.
But if you have too little or too much, it can help you rest into a place that's not good for you.
Sure. If you've got too little, you don't progress. If you've got too much, you injure yourself.
Yeah.
So again, to use the physical fitness analogy, if you don't challenge yourself, you don't progress, and that you stagnate, and that's not good for your self-esteem. That's not good for your kind of sense of worth as a human being. If you stagnate, doesn't feel good. So having too little is on that side. But conversely, if you go into the gym completely untrained and try and deadlift 250 kilos, you're going to hurt yourself. Mm. And the same is true with emotional stress, cognitive stress, any kind of mental stress, is that, again, too little and you don't have a chance to almost prove yourself, not to anyone else, but just to yourself. If you have too much, then you risk an emotional or psychological injury. Because if you're under intense stress for a long period of time, that can break you. And that's where kind of burnout and things like that come from. It is that sweet spot. Now, it's a range. It's a sweet range rather than a spot.
What's the comfort zone, the stretch zone, and the break zone or something. I can't remember what it's called. But there's that sweet spot, the Goldilocks point, where there's just enough to keep you pushing forward.
Yep.
But too much and you buckle under it.
Yeah, and I think that takes a lot of self-awareness to know where you're at on that point. Mm-hmm. And we get told a lot, oh, listen to your body, listen to how you feel, and all of that kind of stuff. But very rarely are we told how to do that.
I don't think we also know how to measure that.
No, because it's not a quantitative thing very mm-hmm. easily. It's very much qualitative, and it's mm-hmm. very much a kind of vague sense of this feels okay, this doesn't feel okay. Mm. And I find that one of the best ways of kind of getting out of your own head and being able to assess how much you're stretching yourself and whether it is an appropriate amount is by journaling, for example. Mm. Because if you get it down on paper, you're almost putting a bit of distance between you and that thing. You're looking at it from a more objective perspective. And almost as if it's another person, you can say, oh, okay, I can see now. Now I've started writing that maybe I'm pushing it a bit too hard and I need to dial it back a bit so that it's more sustainable. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'm sitting back on my laurels a little bit too much and I've got some scope here to push myself a little bit more. Until we start really assessing it, then we don't know. Mm. We don't know where we're at.
So maybe I'm going to step on some very controversial territory here and I might...
That's so unlike you.
right? There is this perception that the generation just below us avoids stress.
Okay.
What would you say about that piece? And I was being polite. If you look on social media, it's a lot more vicious about what they say about the generation. Maybe not the maybe the early 20s. I don't know what that generation is actually, but the early 20s now, that they avoid stress. But I want to add something else into here, which I think is a point. I don't know about whether they avoid stress. I'm not sure. But what I am certain of is the social media world, and this is me taking a shot at social media, is that social media has made life look easy.
Okay.
So you can see a lot of people who are living their best life. Yeah. So you see all the Instagram perception of the best life, and people go, I want that. There must be something wrong with me because I haven't got that.
I think that, so the an interesting thing with the generation perspective.
I saw a little grin there.
It's something which I think there's, it's not black and white. It's not a kind of binary thing here. It's there's a lot of nuance and a lot of subtlety, and to make sweeping generalizations about entire swathes of the population based on their age is to do a disservice to a lot of the individuality within that. However, sometimes you need to generalize in order to have a discussion about something, right? I would say that arguably my generation or our generation, so I was born in 1986, which makes me a millennial.
I'm scraping a millennial. You're just
on the edge, aren't you? So anyone who was born from like the early 80s until the late 90s is considered a millennial. After that is Gen Z, so that would be like the early 20s like you were talking about. The thing which I think that millennials initially were the ones who were getting the short end, drawing the short straw when it comes to people's perception of, oh, these snowflake millennials, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, people have started using the same terminology around the next generation. And so for me, I don't think it's necessarily that that generation are or are not doing or being certain things. I think it's the perception of the generation before them and the generation before that who are becoming old and bitter and going, in my day. And I think that that's where the issue is. I think that if anything, if we're talking about people in their early 20s and Gen Z, are more aware of the fakery around social media and also around the marketing of products to buy this and then you'll be happy kind of thing. I would say that people in their early 20s and younger are more aware of that than I was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And then when it comes to the stress thing, I think that that goes back further than our generation, and we go back to post-war baby boomers, where there'd been a world war, there'd been a huge amount of challenge, a huge amount of adversity that had, the likes of which hadn't really ever been seen before, and haven't really been seen since, no matter what we've kind of, what challenges we've faced recently with pandemics and so on and so forth. The Second World War was on a whole different scale. And after that, when we had this baby boom and people came back from the war and they started having children, there was this big peak in population growth. The parents were like, I don't want my children to have to want for anything.
Yeah.
And it was that generation who were born in the late 40s, early 50s, late 50s, who started that whole movement of wanting an easy life.
One of the things I forget, and I'm going to, the generation, there's no doubt, right? The generation before me, so the X's, is it?
Yeah, so Gen X was the one before millennials.
I'm not sure about the X's, but I know definitely the baby boomers.
Yep.
Rations ended in 1954.
Yep.
So basically, 10 years after the war, everybody's still on rations.
Yep.
So my parents lived through that. So I get exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
That actually, they've overcome. I think we all do it actually.
Yeah, of course we do.
We all overcompensate for the hardships we had.
Yep.
I would never, ever want to do the work that the baby boomer generation did because it was so manual.
Yeah, of course.
And so like.
Yeah, pre-automation. It's a completely different working world.
That was hard work, right? Now we have mentally hard work.
Yeah. it's more emotionally draining than it is physically draining. And I also think that we've come on leaps and bounds in terms of social equality and so on and so forth. Back in the 1950s, the challenges faced by huge segments of the population were completely different to what we've got now.
If you weren't bleeding, it was like, get on with it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. But I think our development as a society has created new problems, new health conditions that years ago would have been, get over it.
I was reading a book recently, and I think the author's name is Gavin Francis, and he's a GP, and he's written a few books as well, and I'm reading this book called Recovery. And it was talking about, recovery is kind of one of my five pillars, if you like, of a fit, healthy lifestyle. And so I was reading this book to see how it fit with my own philosophy around recovery. Part of my philosophy around recovery, just to kind of, the relevance of this, is that recovery doesn't have to be rest. Recovery can be physical labour, because one of the best ways to give yourself psychological rest is to toil physically, right?
Yeah.
And that's why going to the gym is a great kind of stress buster. But, you know, working heavily in the garden and stuff like that, it can be a real good escape from emotional strain, mental strain of the nature of work these days. And in this book, Gavin Francis was writing about what used to be prescribed by doctors for what would have been the equivalent of burnout and anxiety and stress and so on and so forth. And one of the examples they were using in the, I think it was in kind of Victorian era, might have been in the States though, so kind of the late 1800s. And the doctor who used to do this had his flaws. He was of an era. He was very kind of Victorian and stuff like that. No, just kind of make sure I'm doing it. However, he had this thing called rest or west. And what he used to prescribe was either rest, bed rest kind of thing, or going out west, which meant from where they were in the east of the United States, going out into the Midwest or the far west to do manual labor, working on a ranch or something like that, as a means of recovery from their burnout, even though that's not what it was termed at the time. Now, I think the one of the biggest issues with that is that there was a huge gendered split where women were prescribed bed rest and men were prescribed to go out west and work. Thankfully, we've moved past that, but the understanding of, well, actually, physical labour can be a really good recovery tool for times when we're feeling overwhelmed emotionally. So I think that, like with any kind of pattern throughout history, we can learn bits from each stage, and sometimes the pendulum swings too far one way and we become, you know, not softer, but we become more accustomed to a physically easy life, but it's swung so far that we've got a very emotionally difficult life, which is, you know, arguably progress from maybe an emotionally slightly easier life, but a very physically challenging life. Hopefully at some point that pendulum will come to rest somewhere in the middle where we're physically active enough and mentally challenged enough to have a kind of sustainable progress throughout life.
Yeah.
But maybe that's just wishful thinking.
So you're getting your message out on social media. You're on Instagram. You're on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Not Facebook.
Not anymore, no.
Coming back to that point of, it's a lot of it is sizzle.
Yeah.
A lot of social media sizzle.
Really is.
I have this like aversion when people use the word authentic.
It's like, okay. Because it's become a meaningless buzzword.
It's become a meaningless buzzword. And people go, I'm just being my authentic self while sat on the beach in the perfect picture that was probably posed for 20 minutes. I was on holiday and literally, maybe it's inappropriate to do this, there was people just posing on the beach. You're on a beach, beautiful beach in Dubai.
Yep.
It's like amazing. And most of the people there are, there was people just posing for photos to tell the world they were having a great time,
yep,
whilst missing having a great time.
Yep.
How do you find it? Because the fitness world's horrendous for this.
Yeah, it's arguably one of the worst. That and business coaching.
And business coaching, yeah. We're in the same kind of right? No, but I like, I see all this, I have this real dilemma, and I want your opinion on this, right? There are people on there saying, you know, I can get you perfect abs in 90 days,
yep,
stuff.
Yep.
And then there's people in my world going, I can get you your business from 10K to 50K a month in 90 days.
Yep.
All you have to do is pay me $9,000.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So we've both got that kind of sizzle out there. And we're reasonable human beings. We don't want to promise something we can't deliver for every single person. But it seems like some of the people on there will promise it even if only one person gets that. How do you deal with that?
I cover my eyes and my ears and pretend it's not happening. The thing with that is it comes down to, again, this manipulation of what people want, or at least what people think they want. Because the only reason that they want six-pack abs is because they think it will make them happier. Mm-hmm. The only reason that people want a 50K month rather than a 10K month is because they think it will make them happier. Money, fitness, they're both currencies which you can spend on things to improve your quality of life, right? It doesn't matter if you're making a grand a month, 10 grand a month, 50 grand a month. What matters is what that allows you to do and how that impacts your quality of life. It's the same with fitness. It doesn't matter how fit you are. There's no point in being fit for the sake of it. It's what does that allow you to do? Does it allow you to go traveling? Does it allow you to play with your kids? Does it allow you to live a greater number of healthy years towards the end of your life? There's what are you going to spend that currency on? But I think the issue with those things is that really, people have attached their happiness to these kind of external achievements because we've been conditioned to think of happiness as being joy or pleasure. And this is, again, so you talk about authentic being a kind of meaningless buzzword. Happiness, I think, is relatively meaningless. So it's the same reason why I don't use stress to describe how I'm feeling. I don't use happy to describe how I'm feeling because it's so vague. Is it pleasure, joy, ecstasy, or is it contentment and this kind of base level of happiness? And I, you know, through my own journey and my own kind of periods of soul searching due to my own burnouts and my own ups and downs, because we all have them. I've suffered really badly with depression in the past. And through all of this, I've been going, what would make me happier? Especially when I'm in the pits of depression. Why am I depressed? What would make me happier? Now, the thing with depression is it's a bit different because you're not upset about something. It's like a
medical.
Yeah, exactly. But the fact that that triggered that thought process for me helped me once I'd kind of come back out of the medical condition and it was just about managing everyday life. And I realized that actually happiness in a sustainable sense is more like contentment than it is joy and pleasure. Joy and pleasure are like fleeting, transient emotions. Whereas
highs.
They are. And when you start attaching your happiness to the understanding that you're able to process the challenges and the adversities that life throws at you, things won't all be sunshine and rainbows all the time. And life is quite honestly a bit rubbish sometimes, but that's okay. You stop chasing the shiny cars and the shiny six packs. A lot of them on Instagram are shiny six packs, aren't they? They're not only six packs; they're oiled up six packs. Just like, come on.
I mean, you do wonder how people have I don't even know what the word is, but to go. I saw one the other day, and it was a guy stood in front of this big house with two Range Rovers behind him, and he said, "I'm a millionaire. I'm really rich. In fact, I'm worth £20 million. And I'm going to show you how you become a millionaire." And I'm like, I'd probably vomit if I tried to say that. I mean, how crass is that?
I think the word's audacity, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's having the audacity to say that. And I think that, again, it's because the people doing it are still caught up in their own idea of what success is. And they're desperately trying to achieve success and standing in front of a couple of Range Rovers for 60 seconds to do a video makes them feel successful and they think that that's going to get them more sales and so on and so forth.
But who would, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm British, right? I couldn't even possibly imagine, like,
there are British people who do it though.
I know, but right, for an example, I showed this video, we watched this video yesterday, and I showed it to Luke, who runs all our media, he's hiding behind the scenes now, and he said, I think he said something along the lines of, if you ever did something like that, I would resign. And I was like, I'd resign too. It's like,
But I think that it's almost like, yes, there's individual choice. We've all got individual responsibility for what we do, and those people doing that, that's their responsibility. They're making the choice to market in that way. But they're also a product of the environment from a commercial sense that they've grown up in. And if you look at, you know, 1980s infomercials and through into the 1990s, it's that thing.
Yeah.
But what I would say, and this is going back to what we were talking about in terms of generations of people and their understanding of what's going on around them, their understanding of what's on social media and comparisonitis of going, oh, I want that. The teens and 20s of today are so much more aware, because they didn't grow up in the 80s with infomercials and the 90s with infomercials. So marketing has changed. And if you look at where people are spending their money now, they're spending their money with individuals more so than faceless brands.
Yeah.
And I know this is obviously a big part of what you teach. But it's very true. So in the 80s and 90s, it was very much, oh, we can trust them because they're a huge multinational corporation. We can't trust him because that's just Gary from down the road. He could be up to anything. Now, it's, we can't trust that huge multinational corporation because they could be up to anything. But Gary down the road, I know him. I had a pint with him the other week, so I trust him more. Mm. And this whole thing has been flipped on its head so that younger consumers, and this is kind of dripping into kind of older generations as well, this desire to spend money with people that you can see, local shops, and also if you are buying from someone who's further afield, someone who you've developed rapport with through social media, for example. And so the personal brands and the company brands which are doing the best, and I believe this in the fitness industry as well and across into pretty much any industry, are the ones who are open and vulnerable about their own challenges, about their own problems and their own imperfections, and say, hey, this is me, take it or leave it, rather than the ones who are trying to maintain this front or this veneer of perfection.
They're making it human. And
they are. You can't feel connected with someone who you have nothing in common with. Mm-hmm. And whereas if, like, coaching is a prime example of this in anything, whether it's fitness coaching, business coaching, anything like that. If a coach, you want your coach to know what they're talking about, mm-hmm. you want them to have, you know, overcome whatever their challenges are, but you don't want them to pretend they have every single thing in their life perfect, because that to me is a huge red flag, mm-hmm. no matter what the industry is. And so I think that the younger generations are more savvy about that because they haven't been conditioned to believe the sizzle in the same way we have.
Yeah, I hope you're right there. I hope you're right there.
I am an ideologist.
because it is out of control. And what happens is that sizzle creates... It's about like the newspapers, right? Yep. If you think about it, this is like newspapers. You end up where one newspaper puts this shocking headline on and gets a load of attention. So what happens is then somebody else does the same thing to get a load of attention. And what happens is you actually magnify something. That's my biggest concern. Is that
the kind of clickbait side of things.
Yeah, but that what happens is that whilst, you know, we see it already, there's a certain standard... Like TikTok's a bit different, but on Instagram, there's a certain standard that has to happen for something to get out there and to get visible.
Right.
Yeah.
A certain aesthetic kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. And the things that apply that, it creates a, not a class war, but a quality war or an aesthetic war, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I hope, and TikTok is my, TikTok is my, I'm holding on to hope with TikTok, because what I see on TikTok is people doing things that aren't necessarily, they don't have the perfect body. They don't have the perfect life.
It's not all polished.
Yeah, some of it. I mean, I've seen some and I go, I don't know why you put that on. But they're out there and people are celebrating, even though it looks a bit crazy and they aren't, you know, stick thin or image perfect. They're doing something and people are valuing the substance of what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Yeah.
And TikTok is my kind of like, I'm with you. If TikTok's kind of mentality crosses platforms, I think we will affect cultural change on social media.
I think that it is crossing over to a degree, because if you look at Instagram pre-stories, which seems like forever ago now, but obviously stories came about as a result of Snapchat, really, yeah. Didn't it?
What's Snapchat again?
Exactly. Where did that go? MySpace? No, anyway.
Clubhouse?
When that kind of came about, that changed from this kind of perfectly curated grid of Instagram. One of the things I like about Instagram over Facebook, for example, is the simplicity of it. But obviously they did add extra features. And one of the features they added was stories, and then more recently Reels, which was obviously their version of TikTok. That's given the opportunity for more behind the scenes content, if you like. And the Instagram grid is still quite well curated. And it's still quite aesthetic.
I don't know what you mean.
No, was it every other photo is black and white or something? Is that you?
Might be, yeah.
But then the stories, of course, there's still a curation of that. And of course, there is still a wanting to stay on brand if you're promoting a business. But it also is very, very useful for going, well, this isn't a post for the feed, but this is a post so that people can see us packing up the orders, or this is a post for us. And from a personal branding perspective, the ability to do these kind of little kind of piece to camera that they might not have done and put on their grid, I think has increased the authenticity. Sorry, I used the word. But in its actual, you know, definition of being real, I think that those tools have helped. If you look at the engagement, not just the follow accounts, and this is something which is, you know, was a big lesson for me. It's not about how many followers you have, it's about how engaged your followers are, right? And this is true across any platform. If you look at the influencers on Instagram who have the most engagement as a percentage of their overall following, it's not the ones with the most followers. So you may see these shiny celebrity-style Love Island Instagram feeds, which have a couple of million followers, but then you'll see an influencer who has maybe 10 to 15,000 followers, but they are getting so much in the way of traction on each of their posts. And they're not just bots trying to sell you into a crypto scheme.
Or say you've won an iPhone 13.
Yeah, and all of this kind of stuff. But they're genuine people sharing their views on a particular post. And that engagement is incredibly valuable. And so the influencers who are rocking it in influencer marketing and getting paid to promote products, for example, are not the ones with the most followers. They're the ones with the most engaged followers.
Yeah. The ones who can get, you know, the nature of an influencer should be the people who can get people to take action on their words.
Yeah, and that relies on trust. Mm-hmm. And I think that even if people follow, the Kardashians and stuff like that, if you asked how many of those followers do you trust that person that you follow, I think that some people might, some people wouldn't, some people wouldn't be sure.
Do you remember, I can't remember which Kardashian it was, but a photo got out of them before they'd been airbrushed and everything.
Oh, right. That must have passed me by.
No.
And I'm so into celebrity culture as well, Dean.
No, it was fascinating, but you're right. I can't remember which Kardashian it was, but a photo got out that hadn't been airbrushed and they looked like a normal human being. Right?
Shock.
So thank you for watching part one. Come back for the next part with me and Jay.